I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing our Saturday live stream, and our special guest today is David Zutty of the Homeland Institute. David, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be on as always.
Well, today we would like to talk about a new poll that the Homeland Institute did on attitudes about natalism and possible pro-natalist policies. And so I would like to explore this with you for the first hour. And then in the second hour, I would like to take questions from the audience. And those questions can be about anything. But we'll also, of course, talk about this issue of natalism and possible pronatal policies. So, folks, if you would like to send a question in, the best way to do it, the most welcome way to do it, is by doing a super chat. You can do that by going to entropystream.live/countercurrents. It's written across your screen. Go to Entropy Stream and hit the green button. We're not streaming there, but you can still send a donation, a super chat donation. They take credit cards. They are a free speech platform. They have stood by us when we have been deplatformed by the global credit card industry. That's been 5 years now since the merchants who run basically MasterCard put us on a blacklist. And so we've been unable to take credit cards except through this. Also, if you are on Odyssey, you can use your credit card to send an Odyssey tip. And we'd very much appreciate that as well. So David, let's just back up to the very beginning and talk about what was the motivation for doing a poll about people's attitudes towards childbearing and also policies that might improve childbirth.
Yes, so a few months ago, there was an article by the BBC about South Korea's fertility rate. And it is abysmally low. It is 0.7 births per woman. For those who don't know, you need to have, on average, a woman giving birth to 2.1 kids to have a population to remain stable in size. So that's a third. So within a generation, South Korea's population will shrink down to a third. I mean, not instantaneously, but that's the number of children being born. There's going to be old people everywhere, but nobody supporting them. So this is obviously a catastrophe. Japan is not too much better. They're at, I think, 1.26. That's a little bit better, but it's still really, really low, but below that. And we had I wrote an article on this about Prussian socialism versus Korean capitalism, because my analysis of this was that this is mostly a problem with hypercapitalism. Imperium Press did some articles, and they talked about how basically feminism and liberalism came in and completely destroyed these Asian societies because they had no cultural antibodies. We in the West, like we might be at the tip of the spear for the Kali Yuga, but it's also a good thing because it also has allowed us to push through it quicker and also get immunity to it. We know how to deal with these ideas. We didn't have them pop up overnight. South Korea and Japan went from Confucianism and traditional society to liberalism and free markets pretty much overnight, and there is very little to keep stuff together while we've learned how to deal with this. So that's a huge problem because a birth rate that low. The main problem is that you have a tyranny of the old. And it's okay. It's one thing if the population in raw numbers shrinks a little, or even if it shrinks a lot, so long as it remains homogeneous and financially sound. However, when you have a huge drastic reduction in numbers like that, where it's a funnel, where it's like a third of children will be born that should be born, you have this tyranny of the old, and this leads to calls for migration to do work, even though that oftentimes doesn't work out because they either don't leave and they bring crime and they need services. You have to apparently build camps for them. I know Pax Popula has referred to these as barracks. So yeah, so much for our guest workers. We have to feed and house them too, apparently. So yeah, they're not really helping the GDP then. And of course, the old people, I'm not trying to, you know, bag on boomers here, but old people will go along with this because they're short-sighted. They have no connection to the future because they have no kids in such a society. So South Korea's done. At this point, North Korea can just walk in like a generation or two and just conquer the place. Like, they're a done deal. Japan is not looking very good either. And our birth rate is not terribly great either. It's about 1.5 right now for white America. And we don't know what the tipping point, the catastrophic birth rate is. We don't know it yet. I think Japan has already crossed it because they don't have the wherewithal to turn their country around. But again, it's like, why take a chance? So I started asking, what can we do to improve the birth rate to at least mitigate this problem?
Let's just talk specifically about a couple things in the poll. First of all, I understand that you only polled white Americans. Was that registered voters or just white Americans? And what age range did you poll?
So this was registered and some unregistered. It was about 15% unregistered and 85% registered voters. And we also kept the age range to 18 through 35 because those are the fertile childbearing years when these policies would actually matter.
Okay. And
so that speaks less to the electoral viability portion of it, which I'll discuss later, but does speak more to the actual effectiveness of these policies.
Okay.
A future poll might want to expand their poll range, of course, to explore whether how much this is viable or not.
Mm-hmm. So what is the white American birth rate currently again?
That is, we broke it down by party. Right now it is about 1.56. Let me double check that number. I have it right here. 1.55 is my projected birth rate. It's about 1.6, I think.
Okay, so that's well below. That's well below replacement. One of the things, though, that I thought was remarkable about the poll is you looked at their preferred fertility levels, what level that they expected to reproduce at. And it was fascinating that across the board, all of these people, Democrat, Republican, independent, were projecting below replacement fertility, and that the fertility rate that they were actually projecting was lower than the current white fertility rate, which is really alarming. And it's especially interesting, though, that Republicans are far more pro-natal and are far more fertile than Democrats and independents, which really does indicate that left to their own devices, and maybe even with positive incentives, libs and independents are simply not going to exist in a few generations if they have to breed. If you have to breed liberals, they're going to go extinct. If you have to breed independents, they're going to go extinct. If you breed Republicans, they're still going to be around in a few generations. So can we talk a bit about some of that data, dig into some of that? That I found really interesting.
Absolutely, yes. So the first two sets of questions we asked was, how many children do you currently plan on having? And the second question was, how many children would you have if you could have as many as you have? Now, I do need to do a little caveat here. Some of these voters might have, respondents, they might have some fantastical beliefs of what that should entail, like having four or five estates and an Escalade in the shade. But I'm thinking, so we need to put that in perspective. But reasonably, I think they have reasonable expectations, and there was a huge jump. So Republicans, as they were already having more children, already planning on having more children than Democrats and independents. But then the effect of that idea of having as many as you could, their number jumped even more than Democrats and independents, despite how Democrats and independents had more of a gap to make up. So if we look through here, the projected white Republican birth rate is 1.7 based on how many children they have or either already have or they plan on having. But if they could have as many as they could, that number would jump up to 2.54, which is like over 0.8. So that's well above replacement level. They could, if they could do it, they would. So independents and Democrats are basically the party of death. So, and this comes out later on. I'm not being hyperbolic. These people have like a death wish. About a third of Democrats and independents wouldn't have any children at all if they could have as many as they could. And their birth rate, if they could have as many as they want for independents, their actual projected birth rate on the question asked is 1.14. And if they could have as many as they could have, it would be 1.8. So a little bit below replacement level, but not catastrophic. For Democrats, their current projected rate is 1.11, so right at the bottom for hovering around the independent rate. But if they could have as many as they have, Democrats would be 1.67, which is still below replacement level. So Democrats, they're helpless here. And so if we take white America as a whole, our current projected birth rate would drop to 1.32 from, oh yes, I have the number here. The current white American birth rate is 1.6. we can expect it to drop to 1.32 if we do nothing. But if they can have as many children as they want, they'd be at 2.0, which is really, it's at replacement level. It's a little shy of it. So again, we have this thing where a lot of this question comes down to is how much politics is biologically inheritable, as Edward Dutton has proposed. It has to be to some extent. There's probably multiple genes in play. There's nurture. I think it would have a huge thing. I think, yes, we can replace them. We are going to, you know, the white genocide is also white liberal genocide. I mean, we will replace these people. But we cannot rely upon this to naturally happen and save us because, first of all, the consequences of failing is too big. If we go into a death spiral like Japan, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the other issue is that Japan and Korea haven't had this turnaround. Christian Secor wrote an article about how horrible Japan's culture is, despite how we sometimes laud it. And they've been down this horrible rabbit hole. They've gone down the primrose path of low birth rates and cultural devastation more than we have. And they have not had a turnaround. They should have the highest quality people, but they have, it might be a problem where, you know, quality doesn't matter if your quantity is zero or close to it, but there's been no great turnaround of nationalist youth in Japan or South Korea. And that might be because they don't have, you know, mass immigration yet, so they aren't galvanized towards it, but it's, and yes, a lot of this is probably due to different biology because they're Asians and Europeans probably have different political genes in play, and this needs to be studied more. But based upon how there's been no turnaround, I really am not comfortable just relying upon nature to run its course. Like, my favorite saying from Oswald Spengler is, optimism is cowardice. So yes, we can replace these people, but we cannot assume that we can should just let nature take its course and not try to do some sort of state program.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that even if we implemented some aggressive programs to raise birth rates, that liberals and independents would still go extinct. Their preferences are so antinatal that even if we did everything reasonably possible to increase their birth rates, if they had the choice, they still will choose to go extinct. Now, the issue about what influences ideology, is it genes or other factors or both? No matter what, how you answer that, if you say it's nature, it's biology, yes, they're definitely going to go extinct. If it is nurture, well, the primary influence on people's politics is still their parents. And if they liberals are not becoming parents, they're not going to be influencing a lot of people to be liberal, unless, of course, they control education, the media, the entertainment business, and so forth. Then
librarians. There's this weird meme of the subversive librarian. It's like they're trying to reproduce alternatively because they know they can't biologically.
Yeah, there's definitely a truth to that. They can't reproduce, so they recruit. They brainwash. This does happen with the left. This is why they go for educational institutions and culture-forming institutions. It's a way of reproducing, given that they know on some level that they're biologically not going to be represented in the next generation. So they want to find a way that they can propagate their values. And they definitely have a will to power. Even though they are spiteful mutants, they definitely have a massive will to power. And they want the next generation, even if it's not biologically related to them, to reproduce their memes, if not their genes. So yeah, that's still a problem. We would have to get the left out of culture-forming institutions, educational institutions, and so forth. But the fact that they prefer death, basically, makes it a lot easier on us. They're not going to get around, and if they can't influence the children of the people who do have a future, then their ideas will eventually simply be in the pages of the history books.
Yeah, well, we've left arguing with gravestones and senile people in retirement homes. You know, history does belong to those who show up. But another big question I have, and this falls outside the purview of the survey and it requires a lot more research, is what effect does urbanization have on birth rates, both with diversity or without diversity? Because there has been this longstanding correlation that cities are where people go to die. Like Oswald Spengler observed this in ancient Rome and China. It seems to happen at the close of every civilizational cycle. So If we figure that out, we can start designing cities that hopefully do not plummet the birth rate. Like maybe we need to do suburbia, we need to have more green spaces. A lot of it probably has to do with diversity. You don't want to, you know, raise your kids around blacks. But even without blacks, this was a problem in antiquity with megacities. It seems to always happen. So there's something there where cities are, you know, how much of this is causation correlation is still needs to be studied, but there's something there where cities just don't seem to be very conducive towards family formation for whatever reason. It's where influx goes to die.
Yeah. Well, I know that there are some studies, I've seen these cited more than a decade ago, that in the contemporary world, in the modern world, irrespective of things like race and religion, or even types of regimes, the one constant factor connected with low fertility is urbanization. So there is something about urban life, independent of ideology and economy and religion and race, that does seem to suppress fertility. And it would be interesting to know why that is. And yes, it would be fascinating for urban planning to see if we could come up with a pronatal form of city life. I think one factor that definitely influences this, and I came to this conclusion when I lived in New York City, which is the megalopolis. It's the world city in so many ways, the paradigm of the global city. All these people are surrounded by other people. It's so crowded. There are tens of millions of people within the greater urban area, greater New York metro area. And shockingly, so many of these people are lonely. And how is it that so many people can be lonely and yet be surrounded by so many other people? And I went to certain events and I would meet people and I'd go to like book signings and stuff like that. I'd end up going out to dinner with people afterwards, you know, tagging along, just trying to meet people, trying to network. And it was all so frustrating. It was very frustrating because, and I realized that one of the factors that led it to be frustrating was that people assume that there's always somebody more interesting going to come along. And if you've got 10 million people in your city, that's not an unreasonable assumption. And so, yeah, you're chit-chatting with somebody and you take their card and you have a lot in common, but it goes nowhere. Why? Because they think, well, I'm sure they're even better, more interesting people. And so you just get inured to this process of constantly searching for something better. And you never just create relationships, create friendships with the people who are right in front of you. Whereas people in smaller towns with fewer choices somehow manage to form families and friendships that last and actually have families. And so I honestly think that we're miserable and we're infertile and we're lonely in cities because we're free. It's that old meme with the Kaiser Wilhelm on it. You are miserable because you were free. You're infertile because you were free. You are lonely because you were free. You're free in the sense that you have infinite options. And because you have infinite options, you never actually have anything actual going on. It's just all potential. You live in a world of potencies. You're chasing after possibilities and you never settle down and deal with what's right in front of you and realize that, gee, the people you know, the people you grew up with, they might not be perfect, but you're not so special that you can't say they're good enough, right? And when people are just sort of forced to make relationships with the people around them, they find that, yeah, they turn out to be good enough and they turn out to be happy. And I think the people who have all these options and are in the practice of just searching for something better all the time, they never learn that and they never become happy, or they delay it. And this is especially bad with women in cities. Delay it till they're desperate and hit the wall and lose their fertility and they're out of the they're no longer going to contribute to the future.
I think too, a lot of the friendship forming and romances, it comes down to something shared in common. And a rural or suburban setting that can happen because you're from a town area. Like in a city, it's like, oh, you're from District X or whatever, or Brooklyn. It's not the same. It's not really a place where you can belong. You're just kind of passing through. So you have a lot less in common with people. So that's a huge issue. It's you know, oh, we all represent your city. We are all Chicago. No, you're not. You have no connection to it. You just kind of drift around like tumbleweeds.
So what are some of the other interesting findings here just about existing attitudes towards fertility before we segue into looking at some of the proposed incentives to increase fertility?
Right. So that about covered all the differences in attitudes. However, for the barriers, I will give a little taste of that. So the number of Republicans answer they already plan on having two or more children or already have two or more children was 63.1%. So go white Republicans. However, this was compared to 45% independents and 44.5% Democrats. Those are kind of, they're not low, but they're not high either. And Republicans definitely have a decisive lead there. But for the numbers who said, I just don't want to have children, that was only 12.7% of Republicans compared to 31.7% of independents and 28.6% of Democrats, so about 30% of those. So a third of them, almost three-tenths, are going to say, no, I don't want to have kids. So they're definitely in trouble. So first I asked a litany of barriers, and they could pick as many as they wanted. Then have them pick the single biggest barrier overall. And in both methods, the financial cost of raising children overall was the top one, closely followed by the cost of housing. Actually, after the financial cost of raising children overall, it was the worrying about the type of world they'd be born into. But that was driven almost entirely by Democrats and independents. So that's huge. So for the single biggest barrier, 5.9% said worried about the type of world they'd be born into. It's so cliche. But that was driven by 7.4% Democrats, 8.2% independents, versus only 2.4% Republicans. And I bet if we actually were to interview these Republicans when they said that, they meant stuff like inflation as opposed to climate change or Trump is doing microaggressions against transgender people. These people are so fragile. So that was the second one overall after we, of course, got rid of the other two things that you already plan on having two or more children or you just don't want to have children. Yeah, and then for the section where they could click as many as they wanted to, the financial cost overall was 31.7%, followed by the type of role they were born into at 23.8%. And again, there was a drop-off between independents, Democrats, and Republicans. And then there was, again, so it's weird how this also, you break this down by party. The third biggest overall, not amongst Republicans, was doubts about whether they would make a good parent. But that was, again, driven by Democrats and independents, not by Republicans. And so when it comes down to Republicans, it's all money, money, money. For liberals, it's like this vague hysteria. It's not actually, it was weird because I was expecting a lot more would say it was they'd interfere with having fun, especially for liberal women. But there was very little difference between liberal or independent men and women about, I forgot how exactly worded, but just having fun, it would interfere with that. But it's very strange how a lot of these things like climate change, it's all driven by liberals. So what that means is that not only are Republicans more fertile overall, they are more likely to benefit from these policies, which is good because one of the kind of pushback I get from discussing this was that people were worried, like, is this just going to become another welfare program? Are we funding our own replacement? And no, in our own race, this will definitely help Republicans get even a stronger lead on out-reproducing Democrats and independents. And while I don't have data on it, I only pulled white Americans. What we know about K and R selection theory, I think this would definitely help white Americans. I'll go over what specific policies we can implement too, which should benefit us. But the concerns about this about any type of pronatal policy turning into a welfare program, we definitely need to address that. But it's not a big one because people like that who have a lot of kids anyways, they're going to do it no matter what. You know, random immigrants, blacks, they're mostly unfazed by this. And I'll discuss that later. So this is good. We can definitely get our birth rates up and help our own people with this policy. And regards to the cost of it, we're just getting a rebate on money that was already stolen from us. Everyone else gets welfare. They're already on a de facto UBI. We have welfare queens. It's time for white people to get some get some of their own hard-earned money back, I think. But yes, those are the top barriers. It was mostly financial, and that was good. And again, concern about the climate, that was only working on Democrats and independents, not on Republican women. Republican women are not buying up this weird antinatalist propaganda.
Let's talk a little bit about the difference in attitudes between women and men, because I thought that was very interesting. It seems like, first of all, the Republican women have basically the same attitudes about a lot of these things as Republican men, which indicates that they're fairly sensible. And I think that this goes a long way to undermining some of the extremely negative attitudes that people on the right have about women. It turns out that the worst women are largely concentrated in the independent to Democrat categories. They're the ones who are most neurotic, most antinatal, and that they're very sensible women in the mainstream of society and rather large numbers of them. So can we talk a bit about that?
Yes. So this is this thing where I've noticed where there's a social media kind of bias that comes about because liberal women are very shrill and obnoxious and they like to show off all the time on social media. And liberal men are more quiet. They're busy playing with their Funko Pops or whatever they do with their time or craft IPA beers. So they're not, you know, virtue signaling all the time about all their antinatal nonsense. That's their women who do that for them. While on the right, it's mostly men who are more louder and aggressive, either anonymously or with a real face and name. While conservative women, whether that's like more dissident women or just normie conservative women, they're more naturally quiet. So they aren't running around on social media all the time. So, which also gets, if I can comment on this quickly, the whole Lauren Southern nonsense was it was a psyop. It was all fake. We weren't driving a woman. This is just her lived experience as in something she made up. That was some drama that flared up a few weeks ago where she is demanding we become less toxic, but that's not real, I think. But yeah, however, liberal women were pretty rotten, actually. Although this is, you know, this is within Democrats, not Republicans. So one of the barriers, it wasn't necessarily a barrier, but why people didn't want to have kids was 3.7% of Democrats overall said they preferred adoption. This went up to 5.2% of Democrat women, which shows that liberals and liberal women have a strong out-group preference. But this isn't something that goes on with Republican women. There's really no difference there. So it was extremely low among, it was like 1%, and I assume that's simply because of biological issues, maybe. So that is very, very good. A lot of this women bashing, it's, you know, I'm not a white knight, but a lot of this is because social media warps people's perspective of reality. There was a small issue where finding a suitable partner, it dropped for women compared to the average, which means that the average for men raised by that went up by that amount. So there is something there where it might be hard to find a nice woman now. There might be, that is an issue. But Republican women, at least, they can find men who are decent. Republican men, that is a problem. It is something that needs to be addressed. And maybe we need to look at square dancing or something, but it is an issue.
It's very interesting, though, that Republican men seem to be pickier than Republican right. women, which undermines another one of these manosphereian memes, which is all of these women, they're just going to have to settle. They're too narcissistic. They're so vain. They think they can get Mr. Perfect, yada, yada, yada. It turns out that Republican women are significantly more reasonable in their expectations of men and more likely to rate themselves able to find somebody than Republican men. And yeah. And part of that, I think, has to do with the calculus of expectations. They're willing to settle.
Right.
Either, you know, this is something to dig into, I guess, and maybe we could actually test this. Is the reason why Republican women think that they're more likely to find somebody acceptable that they rate themselves so highly that they're sure that somebody will snap them up? Or is it that their standards for men are more reasonable and therefore they feel like they're more likely to get a man? That's actually a difference that could be tested through asking more specific questions, I suppose. And the same with the men.
I think Republican men are just better overall. Like a liberal, liberal women have to deal with soy boys, so that's a huge problem. That's how you wind up with polyamory weirdness in that section of society, and it's very weird and icky. But yeah, that's good. I think, yeah, that is a good thing, and it's something we need to explore more. But I also found out, so doubts about whether respondents make a good parent, probably justified on the left.
Mm-hmm.
So among Republican women, that barrier decreased a little to 8.7%. It was a small decrease, but it spiked up by a bunch to 22% of Democrat women, 22% of independent women. So among liberal women, yes, they probably do think they would make a bad parent, and they probably are correct in that assessment from what I've seen of them. And then the classic children interfering but doing fun things. So there's a slight decrease among Democrat women to 18.6% from 19.5% of all Democrats. And then also Republican women had a small decrease in that from 8.5% of all Republicans to 7.1% of Republican women, but also rose a little bit among independents. So independents are just very, you know, Democrats are more antinatal overall, but independents were like the most kind of like self-indulgent.
Interesting. Now, let's just back up though. So you're looking at the average for Republicans, and then you're breaking the women out, and right, the women are less so. So right, for Republicans and Democrats, more men, slightly more men than women, didn't want to have kids because they wanted to have fun, basically.
Correct.
Let's travel and go to parties. Yeah. So that's interesting. So it's a slightly more male than female attitude with Democrats and Republicans, and slightly more female than male with the independents.
Right. And we have to keep in mind that this poll has a plus or minus 3% accuracy rating, but it is highly suggestive. It might be more of a man thing for, you know, Democrats and Republicans. It might not, but even if it's not, it's really that just make it right on the mark. So for every hoe on Instagram going on about how they want to go to Morocco and maybe be decapitated while eating ethnic slop, there is at least one soy boy playing with their stupid Funko Pop too and soying over Marvel movies. So this whole meme of like, it's women driving this because they want to travel, that's a social media narrative that was kind of like, it's just, you know, no, social media is a mirror of reality, but it's not an accurate mirror. And that's the thing, like it, the little soy boys, they aren't posting about how they are not going to have kids because they're playing with their stupid Funko Pops. It's the women who are doing it. It's usually liberal women who are louder, and conservative men who are louder. So, and two, it's the fact that it's not a huge, it's actually more Republican men would seem to be more of the carefree lifestyle than Republican women is good. And kind of also destroys this manosphere narrative too. I mean, yeah. The only one where it was different was independents, where it was 18.3% of all independents versus 22.2% of independent women. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. Again, the numbers are fairly similar. And so what you can say basically is that it's probably not the biological difference between men and women that's being manifested here. It's just we live in a culture that emphasizes individualism and hedonism and so forth. And men and women in various sections of the electorate are pretty much equally susceptible to that, which I think is fairly fascinating. Of course, antinatalism for women has more deadly consequences for the race than antinatalism for men, for the simple reason that, let's say that a woman goes through a 25-year antinatalist phase, and if she comes out of it, well, too bad, too late. It's you're not going to have a family. Whereas men, if they have a 25-year antinatalist phase, they can still hopefully have a family after that. It comes down to basically sperm is cheap and eggs are dear. There are fewer eggs produced than sperm, and therefore attitudes that take women out of the breeding pool, out of the gene pool, are more threatening to the survival of a society than things that take men out of the reproductive race. Because if 90% of men died, we could still reproduce the species. The 10% who were alive would have to have multiple wives or something, but I'm sure they could rise to the challenge. But if 90% of women died, it would be a catastrophe that most societies probably could not recover from.
Right. And there's a huge problem too with the debt issue. I know, like, finding a mate, it's you prefer a woman not to have debt. That's the issue too. If they're going through an antinatalist phase, they aren't just wasting their time. They're probably accruing debt with student loans because they're going to college, get educated, so they get a career, but the career doesn't pay that well. And then they're probably devaluing themselves in other ways and just wasting time. They're also have all this debt. And as we found here, economics was a huge barrier. So if they were to change their mind, now they're saddled with debt and they're stressed out. This just makes it even less likely.
So are there any other barriers to reproduction that you want to talk about before we get on to the pronatalist policies?
I do want to emphasize that the number one reason was financial cost of raising children overall at 9%. And I'm going to combine this. I'm going to go down a little bit and jump down a little bit to cost of housing, which is about 1%, is 0.9%. Let's say 1%. So we have 10%. This is an important part of the math I did later on. So let's assume that we could fix that for these people, where they can make it easier to raise kids, somehow ease the cost of housing, either directly or indirectly. Well, at that point, let's say that they each had one kid each. That would raise the fertility rate by 0.1. Not a lot, but maybe that could be the difference between going down to a demographic catastrophe and just having our absolute numbers decline a lot. But if we look at let's jump to the beginning at first, where he said, like, hey, how many children would you have as many as you could? So that answer to that question is my maximum, the most fantastical number you could get for pronatalist policies for impacting the birth rate. So it's like 0.3. The bare minimum, based upon the answers of what their biggest barrier was, is 0.1. So it's probably somewhere in the middle, around 0.2. And that would make sense based upon what we saw in Hungary, because Hungary, I'll talk about that later on, but they did very similar policies. Actually, I'm going to segue about and talk about now. This pulled out a lot of different moving parts. You know, it's a very multifaceted policy issue with all these things interacting with each other. So I'm going to talk about that now, actually, about Hungary, my people. In Hungary, they began a huge suite of pronatal policies in 2011. And the main policy of that was an income tax reduction, where if you had so many children, you had a 50% income tax reduction for life. If you had, I think, four or more, you had a 100% income reduction for life. This increased their birth rate by over 0.3. It was very low, as I think, of about 1.2. So that was as bad as Japan's, basically. And part of that was that the economy was just rough. They did just come out of communism in 1989. Iron Curtain fell, and it was a rough transition. And communism sucks. It left a lot of deep scars on the country, and it took a while to get stuff going. And finally, in 2011, they did these aggressive policies, and it worked. They got the birth rate up. And part of the birth rate rising, too, wasn't just the economic stuff. It was that people had a general more positive outlook on life, because you had the post-Soviet malaise that began to go away, too. So that would also kind of correlate with how people were talking about the general state of the world. Part of that, this might be, you know, liberal hand-wringing, but part of that is probably economic. So Hungary proves this. It proves that we probably get, bare minimum, a 0.2. I would say I'm a little bit conservative in that, as opposed to like 0.3 or 0.25, because we have a lot of cultural issues in the West compared to the East. We also have a lot of other problems. And we're not rebounding from a post-Soviet malaise. We're going down into like what might be a permanent recession, with thanks to Bidenomics. But there's that. So that proves that this all works. And I'm going to talk about the electoral viability next, if you don't mind. We found that overall, people were less likely to vote than to vote for them overall. So you might say, well, this is not electorally viable. However, this is mostly driven by Democrats who, again, has some type of weird antinatal death wish. It is entirely driven by Democrats. In fact, among independents and Republicans, even more independents were more likely to vote for a candidate who proposed pronatal policies than against him. That's big, because Democrat voters for a Republican candidate, especially a populist Republican candidate, they're simply not on the cards anyway, so you can't lose what you don't already have. So that's good. And also, this might be a way to also address the abortion problem. because abortion has become a hot topic again, and it's because Roe versus Wade was overturned a few summers ago. And this gets the left riled up. They get very emotional about this. People break out their pussy hats, and they go to the polls. And we don't want to antagonize an enemy, especially when abortion is mostly them killing themselves. So the thing here, and going back to Hungary, is that the abortion rate in Hungary dropped by 41% between 2011, when they enacted their pronatal policies, and 2021. That's a way to slash abortion by a huge amount without actually telling people they can't have an abortion. And most of the people who had kids instead of an abortion, these are probably more eugenic people. These are people who were forced into an abortion due to economic reasons as opposed to cultural or reasons, which really come down to just being dysgenic. So this is big. So actually having Hungarian-style policies, it won't just raise the birth rate, it will also fight abortion. And I think this is a big deal where we can placate the religious right and get them on board with something there everyone can agree upon. It's not galvanizing, even though some Democrats simply are just perpetually triggered by anything that's pro-life. Like, this is a way to be pro-life without being anti-abortion. And if the religious crowd refuses to go along with this, if they say, no, it's not enough to have these pronatal policies, we want to have like no abortion at all, they're just an abortion extremist as much as the pussy hat crowd. And we can't deal with these people, and they need to be maligned and told to shut up. They cannot be allowed to hijack the party and galvanize the Democrats. And I'll be blunt, just create more. We already have enough George Floyds and FBI agents in America. We don't need to create more.
So you want to move now to the pronatal policies?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll go on to that. And also, this wasn't popular amongst unregistered voters, but it was. There were a few unregistered voters who did like it, and so this might be they can't vote less than they already do, and they probably aren't going to go jump and vote for a candidate they haven't already. With all the political polarization, all the energy, if they haven't gotten down to the polls. Based on that, they won't do it because someone proposed pronatal policy. So don't worry about them voting against you. But a few extra unregistered voters could be a way to turn the tips in an election, because politicians are always chasing that 1-2% that might tip it from 49-51%. So
right.
I think.
So you're saying that in terms of unregistered voters, are they more likely to vote for pronatal policies than vote against pronatal policies?
They're more likely to vote against it. Well, they said they'd be less likely to support a candidate.
Okay.
However, they're unregistered, so how they can't really do anything about it. They're not, unless they register to vote again out of fury at these policies being proposed, that simply isn't likely because they haven't registered to vote.
Yeah. It's a level of nihilism that would lead them to do this, that if they were nihilistic enough to register to vote against pronatal policies, they'd already be registered Democrats.
Right. And if you want the number of those who were likely to vote, it's 15.2%.
Okay.
Compared to 41.7%, no effect either way. Actually, unregistered, that was about half just don't care either way unregistered because, well, of course, they're unregistered. They're apathetic. So only 15.2% would vote for these, but hey, that could be an extra 1% that tips the balance.
Yeah. Now, which percentages of Democrats are fervently antinatalist, as opposed to wouldn't mind pronatal policies? What percent of Democrats would actually vote for more pronatal policies if a candidate were advocating them?
So 3%, a lot more likely, 4%, somewhat more likely, and 12.3% of Democrats, a little more likely. So that's about 7% for a lot or somewhat more likely, 12% a little more likely, so about 20% more likely. So that you might get a few Democrats there too who are populist.
Yeah. So about 20% of Democrats would be more likely to vote for a candidate who had pronatalist policies. What percentage are indifferent?
That'd be 40.9%.
Wow. So that gets you up to 60%. So that means about 40% would be more likely not to vote for a candidate who proposed pronatal policies.
Correct. And this is crazy amongst Democrat women. So I think the whole, Yeah, the whole crazy female not wanting to have kids thing, it's mostly Democrat women driving this. So if we combine all these numbers, that's 40%. That's about 52% of Democrat women were less likely to vote for
Fascinating.
somebody who,
But
so
a
they're just
significant,
perpetually triggered.
But a significant number of those women think they would be bad parents. And that's,
Correct.
and they're, as you said, they're probably right. And one of the things that choice allows one to do is not have kids if you don't think you'd be a good parent. And so that is definitely one of the few eugenic things about, say, voluntary birth control and stuff like that. I mean, voluntary birth control mostly is dysgenic because what it does is it causes people who are responsible and think about the future to have fewer children. Well, we want more people in the future who are responsible rather than fewer. Whereas the people who don't think about the future and don't care at all, they don't use birth control. And so their percentage of the population steadily rises. This has been known since the 19th century, right? Since eugenics was first discussed, that birth control will be generally dysgenic. However, one eugenic factor is that people who are correctly judging themselves bad parents and maybe genetically unfit, they can at least opt out.
Yeah, they definitely can.
So, in terms of electoral viability, what percentage of Republicans would oppose, be less likely to vote for a candidate who champions pronatalist policies?
That'd be about 18.5%.
18.5%. That's astonishing to me. And
This
to
is
what?
Nikki Haley voters. They do exist, apparently.
Yeah, I would say it's Nikki Haley voters. It's probably people who think that that's a dad burned government welfare program type people, the limited government people, the
How
libertarian
dare
type.
productive people get something that will help them for once instead of just giving it to, welfare black cases in the hood who are just like helpless? How dare they?
So, but and I'm sure there are a number of feminist Republicans who are made uncomfortable by that kind of policy as well. But it'd be very interesting in a future study to dig into what are the causes of antinatalist attitudes within the Republicans.
Yeah, that's weird too, because kind of backtracking what I said about the antinatalism being both genders, the more Republican women were opposed at a total of, so about 23% of Republican women were less likely to vote, which is higher. So it's like this weird thing where they don't like it. They feel like this is imposing upon them, or how dare you, or dumb cliches about baby machines. And it's weird because they didn't seem that bad in the other parts of the poll, but then this came out where it came down to let's, put the rubber to the road and make some policies, and they didn't like it. Maybe they're worried they're going to have to pay for somebody else doing it, or if I don't want to have kids, why should I pay for this? But it's strange how this pops up again. It's not at the level that of the manosphere for sure, but it is an issue where there is something in the culture there where they do not like that, and it just might they might sense that this is another. It just might be a dumb cultural thing, like The Handmaid's Tale or something, and they feel they're being objectified, which is so weird because the primary purpose of a woman is to be a mother. The primary purpose of a man is to be a warrior, even though most men won't do war stuff. And how many men fantasize about war? And if they aren't going to do it, they valorize it. It's in their computer games, their literature. Even normies, they respect the troops and, bronze statues and all that. And it's just understood that's not something you counter signal. The number of men who are really, if they're anti-war, they're not anti-warrior. Then it's a few libtards. But women, it's like they have this, how dare you? And it's like, this is you're like a flower. You have to bloom. You have like, this is your destiny. This is your life cycle, like beavers building dams and caterpillars becoming butterflies. Like, this is life. It's a circle of life, and just you gotta enjoy it. And just like, try to, stop trying to rebel against nature and what you actually probably want.
Yeah, well, it's just how pervasive and destructive feminism is in our culture. If we could just find the switch, find the key, and shut off the feminism engine, things would change very, very quickly, I would imagine. But until that happens, it is just astonishing the number of women, including women who are conservative in many ways, who just come out with this crazy nonsense. When the rubber hits the road, yeah, they're going to be shrieking about The Handmaid's Tale just as much as libtards, and that's disturbing. So what percentage of Republicans are indifferent to pronatal policies?
44.2%, and for independents, that number is 50%.
Okay. And what percentage of Republicans would be more likely to support a candidate who puts forward pronatal policies?
So that'd be 37.5%, which they definitely outnumber those who are against it at 18.5% by about 2-1.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the people who are indifferent, well, they're indifferent. They don't matter. They're not going to get upset about it, but they're not going to get out and vote for it. So that seems like a very much winning policy for populist Republicans to take. And it might.
I want to quickly compare this number here, where the number of Republicans who are opposed, okay, that is a total of 18%, let's say 18%, versus the 19.5% Democrats who are somewhat, at least a little more likely, which makes up for the Republicans that you're going to lose, actually. It's about the same, actually. You might actually get a little bit more, a few more Democrats than Republicans you lose, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, it might get a few independents, too. And here's the thing.
Well, actually, more than a few. There were more independents in favor of pronatalist policies than opposed.
Oh, what was the percentage that are pronatal policy?
About 28% of independents are more likely versus 22% who are a little less likely.
Interesting. Well, that's very interesting. I honestly think that Republican populists could do very well if they put forward a pronatal platform. So let's talk a few about the most popular pronatal policies. The number one concern that most people had preventing them from having as many children as they would want is connected with financial stuff. And you can break that down in different ways. Practically all concerns have a financial element to it, housing, schools, stuff like that. So money is the number one factor. So what are the most popular proposals that you found for increasing birth rates?
Right. So we gave a bunch of different policies or factors, and we had respondents rate them on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being not very likely at all, 5 being very likely. And the top one was making it easier to support a family on a single income instead of 2. 32% of Republicans rated that a 5, 20% as a 4, for a total of 52.4. For Republicans, the total number of 4s and 5s combined is 63.8%. And this is big because this is the most biggest factor. And it's the one that we're going to have the most problems with because feminism, which lauds women in the workplace, so therefore what you get is you simply have more workers. Well, you can pay them less. You basically get, this simply depresses wages. And also there's corporate greed, where, you know, if you get away with paying people and making them have to combine two incomes to have a middle class lifestyle, why not? And that's a huge problem because we're going to butt heads with corporate greed, immigration, and feminism. Because immigration also depresses wages, and businesses know this and they like it. But you have to fight this. This is the biggest thing. And one of the big points I want to make here is that in the 90s, Homer Simpson was not like a fantasy setting. This wasn't Dungeons and Dragons. A working class man was able to, Homer Simpson, who wasn't that bright, was able to support a family of 4, actually 5, and a pet on a single income. Marge didn't work. And they had a nice home. It wasn't like a mansion, but it was a nice home. And there were other bunch of working class people in this neighborhood too. And this wasn't considered fantasy like Lord of the Rings. It was real. And if I was a candidate, I would propose 1 for 40, that one man or person working 40 hours a week at a non-entry-level job should be able to support a family of four. Doesn't mean a vacation every year, but they're not destitute. And this will cause all these corporate interests and feminists to shriek, but this is what we have to do. This is absolutely necessary. And then the other thing, too, is just making housing more affordable in general. This is very high for the total number of 5s and 4s overall was 43.9%. For Republicans, 51.9%. So this is where we need to get to. It's also like housing is a huge issue because despite how we have a declining population, you have immigration. And it's just not affordable. Like, it's difficult to live places. Now, that's why we have a California exodus. But then this is the first policy we hit where it's an actual policy and not a factor. And this is big. A lifetime 50% income tax break for parents of 2 children and a 100% lifetime income tax break for parents of 3 or more children. So 21.7% respondents rated as a 5, 19.8% as a 4 for a total of 41.5%. For Republicans, the total combined was 51.1%. And this is big because of a number of reasons. First, this is what worked in Hungary. This was the flagship policy of the 2011 policies that they enacted. Was this expensive? Yes. Hungary had to take a hit to their GDP to debt ratio, which I'll talk about later probably. But you'll take a bigger hit to GDP to debt ratio if you don't have kids in the long term. So yes, this costs money, but it will cost even more money not to have children. If you look at Japan's GDP to debt ratio, it's 260%. That's worse than America's 120% right now. And America is a lot that was driven by COVID, but also by Obamacare and people not having kids. So, yeah, it's like you will have to take a hit, but it's worth it. It will be more costly not to do this. And two, this is probably the best policy overall because it mostly rewards productive people. Black people don't make a lot of money. This won't really help them. There's not many of them, so we're not really losing money on this. This makes us less likely to become a welfare program. In fact, it can't because you have to be working and making income for this to even affect you to begin with.
Right.
This won't become another Gibbs program where it simply redistributes wealth from white people to black people.
Mm-hmm.
This would benefit white people the most. This would finally be a policy that benefits white people more than other races. Finally. And we know it's commonly said that a purpose of a system is what it does. The current system just so happens to redistribute white tax dollars to black people and Hispanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On purpose.
Yeah, absolutely.
This would change that, finally. We'd finally get, a rebate on the money that we're plundered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's impressive. So what other programs rated highly? Let's get into Dem programs now. What are those programs that white voters rate highly and would actually respond to as incentives to have larger families?
All right, so the next thing that became up, the next highest factor of policy was free or subsidized medical care, medical insurance for middle-class families, which, again, it goes back to that racial redistribution. All these poor people in California, they have like CalPERS or Medi-Cal, and it's mostly Hispanics or immigrants. And so they get these free GIBs. They get free health insurance. But if you want health insurance in California, it's astronomical because you're paying for all these people who are either uninsured, underinsured, getting sick all the time. Like, I went years in California without health insurance while in law school after the Air Force, because, like, I'm not sickly. I don't go to the doctor. I'm not paying for all these other people in the hood. They just leech off the system. They don't pay their ER bills. So someone has to pay eventually. And we're paying one way or another. It's either through insurance, through taxes, through debt, through inflation. You get hit with it as a white man. So finally giving, okay, if all these Hispanics and poor people and immigrants get their medical care and medical insurance, we should get it too. We should get that too. And 41.2% of all respondents rated it as a 4 or 5, and 43.4% of Republicans did as well. And that makes sense. It's medical insurance is just a scam, in my opinion. It should just be, doctor stuff should be like a haircut and maybe have like haircut insurance, but this is ridiculous. We're being paid through this subversive middleman for stuff we don't even need. So that'd be something I definitely support too. Like, finally give us some Gibbs, which is why I'm for UBI too. I know Scott Greer was going on about how if a white person takes welfare out, that's bad. Well, I would agree too, like 20 years ago, but let's be honest, we've already been fleeced this is our money. We're taking some of it back now.
Yeah. I really didn't like that particular exchange, that particular discussion that happened on Twitter. Whiteness is not and should not be middle-class Republican coded, which is basically what he's trying to do. He's trying to say, if you're not a middle-class Republican, then you're not white. Well, there are a lot of people who are white, and for whatever reason, for instance, the behaviors of the middle class and upper middle class and business class who fall into poverty, and they should be able to get welfare and unemployment and medical coverage because of that. And one should not hang one's head in shame at being a white person using emergency programs or just regular programs. So yeah, I think there's a big conversation to be had in our circles about that. And it's basically just the debate between, you know, the welfare state and this residual classical liberalism in America that's such a strong feature, especially on the right, for whatever reason.
Yeah, bootstraps.
Yeah.
And two, it's I want to push back against possible strawmanning where we're saying just be a loser and be on welfare. We are not saying that. We're saying if you apply, get your gibs. And that includes like some gibs that aren't just like for destitute people. Like if there's some program that helps you, why deny yourself that? You paid for it. We paid for it. And I'm sure rich whites who are white nationalists want you to take advantage of it if you qualify for it. So why should we deny ourselves what everyone else is, you know, grasping at? And there's no dignity involved here because we're in a decaying multiracial empire. Everybody's looting this dead carcass. This already died. The debt ratio is at 122% to GDP. This is over. We're not paying that back. Everyone is out to disenrich themselves, whether that's a corporation. I mean, if you know who the biggest welfare queens are, they're not in the hood. They're in Wall Street. They're on corporate welfare, getting them tax breaks. So let's not get all high and mighty here. The upper and lower classes don't get all emotional about this. We shouldn't either here.
Right.
And this is something that I had to change my opinions on. I was definitely a proud middle class person. I would never do that. That is so beneath me. And I have changed my opinion because I have come to the reality that I'm living in a decaying multiracial empire. And that's just that. I have to change. It's reality. And we can't afford to deny ourselves stuff that we qualify for.
Right. So are there other
problems too in the military where we have so many people who, you know, veterans who should go and get their gibs, but the problem is that a lot of these veterans are white and therefore they have and they're warriors and they don't want to go. They don't like doctors too. And it's like, no, if you're having issues and this is this like sleep apnea, get your gibs. Like you have earned this. Even if it wasn't combat related, you have earned this. And we'll make everyone happy. Like these things exist for you. The VA exists for you. We want you to get your rating. You have earned it. There's no shame. And it's like pulling teeth.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's an attitude that just makes us suckers, and parasites sense that, which is why we have millions of parasites besieging the country to get in. They're besieging the country to get in so they can leech off the people who are responsible and have that work ethic, the people who put more into the system than they take out. They're the ones that are basically attracting these legions of locusts that are going to strip the country bare. What are some of the other policies that were highly rated that you proposed?
All right, so there is financial help for first-time home buyers with either a grant or an interest-free loan. That was 4 or 5 combined, 40%, and among Republicans, 47.3%. That might be abused a little bit, but it's for responsible people, so I think that's a good policy. When we get into dangerous zones, that is actually the lump sum. That was, for all respondents, 38.2% rated it as a 4 or 5, and 46.6% of Republicans rated it as a 4 or 5. But I can also see this being abused. So it's
a lump sum. How much?
And $10,000.
So $10,000 per kid.
Yeah, and the problem is that under the civil rights regime, we can't really discriminate on race. So we have to until we either get a national divorce and can therefore have opportunity to rewrite case law and all that. We just have to deal with the civil rights paradigm. And so there's a big danger there that we're simply going to be funding more baby mamas in the hood. Like, let's be real here.
Well, yeah, they have very high time preferences. And so $10,000 lump sum, that seems like a gazillion dollars. Right. And they can get it relatively quickly. They can get it 9 months. Well, that's still quite a lot of planning ahead for low IQ, impulsive people, though. In fact, that might be too much planning ahead for it to actually really have that much of an effect. It's interesting. That's something that could be empirically studied, I suppose. But yeah, the bigger upfront lump sum type thing. Well, if they got paid it just for getting pregnant, that would be a catastrophe. But yeah, I can see that. You really want to craft policies that are most appealing to people with high IQs and low time preferences who think far into the future.
Right. And there is a bunch of other policies. They became more less and less popular, like 3 months of government parental leave for each child, free college tuition, subsidized childcare. And then eventually, one of the ones that was very lowly rated, and I really don't recommend this at all, was $150 per month for each child until the age of 18, because not only was this not highly rated, only 33.9% of all respondents rated it as a 5 or 4, but Poland tried this, and this had almost no effect on the birth rate. It simply didn't work. It did reduce child poverty, so if you want to do that, that's good. But we also have to keep in mind then that in America, this would just be abused by blacks probably. And this would just be another Gibbs program. It would not raise white birth rate. And there are other things like parenting classes, therapy or support groups. That might be worth doing just because it will not have a strong effect. But if you can do it for a lot cheaper than some of these other things like an income tax break, that could help a little bit. And I think one of the biggest ones, it was the second to last, but still as important, was how 22.7% of Republicans said rated a 4 or 5 as if many of your friends became parents too, which is big because it means that any of these other policies will have a ripple effect. It might not be a huge ripple, but we're going to get more than what we bargained for.
Right.
Which is good.
Right. So if the tax break makes Jill and Jack have a kid, their neighbors and Jill's sister and her circle of friends are going to be more likely to have kids, not just because of the tax break, but because it's catching on. And that's terribly important.
A lot of this is just scary because it's child rearing has become this like unknown land, almost like death, where people are not familiar with it. So it's exotic and weird and scary because you can't go back. But if all the cool kids are doing it, they'll do it too. And two, this is big because this is the ones who responded that it would have an effect upon them. The ones who there's probably a lot of respondents who it would have an effect upon them, and they just don't think it does. It would have to happen. I've seen this in real life with like lived experience. It's not scientific, but people I knew had kids, and then everyone else was like, "Oh, maybe I'll have a kid too," and it kind of broke the ice. It became less scary.
Yeah.
And then they have people they can rely upon to do babysitting and trade babysitting duties back and forth, so they can still have fun and all that. So I feel this weird idea that you're basically like locked down, enslaved if you have kids and can't have fun. But it's like, no, you have friends who do babysitting, or you have your parents. Like, there's like grandparents tend to like kids. Like, that doesn't seem to like people don't get that. Like, your parents all of a sudden become a lot nicer when you have kids because they want to spend time with them.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. I remember I lived in Atlanta in 2005 to 2010. And the first 4 years of that time, I lived in the Virginia Highlands neighborhood, which is an older in-town neighborhood, very nice neighborhood that had been quite, it never had gotten bad, but it certainly had sort of gentrified. And it was full of white, middle-class, upper-middle-class professional families. And I noticed during the time that I was there that a lot of these families had two kids. And the two kids might be 6 and 8 or 8 and 10. And then I noticed over basically a three-year period, suddenly these families started having a third kid. And there was one baby carriage, and then there was another and another and another. And over a three-year period, I can think of, I don't want to be vague here. Let me just try and run through my, I can think of six couples that lived near me that suddenly had the third kid. And it was always like 4 to 6 years after the second kid. Like they got a second wind. And I'm pretty sure they might have all known one another, or they at least they were familiar strangers. And I wondered, what's going on here? Is it something in the neighborhood? Is it something in the zeitgeist? Because when you have two kids, you've reproduced yourselves. It's the third kid that you have that reproduces the race, that reproduces your nation, because that gets you from 2, which is below replacement, to 2.1, and way beyond 2.1. 3 is way beyond the 2.1, right? It's going from 2 kids to 3 is going from slow decline to healthy growth. And it would be really an interesting project to look into the psychology and incentives connected with going from 2 to 3, because that's the big history-making, epic-making change that we want. We want to go from 2 to 3 on average, and that'll save us. That'll save any country, that gets people over that hump, over the inhibitions, whatever those inhibitions are. Maybe we just need to change the picture of the happy average family. The happy average family should no longer be 2 parents, 2 kids, and a golden retriever. It should be 2 parents, 3 kids, and a golden retriever, maybe. So that's...
We have to return to the Simpsons, return to tradition.
Yeah.
3 kids.
Yeah. And the gap between the first two and the third was significant, right? So again, it's an interesting pattern. And I think a lot of couples go through that where they think, okay, we've got our two, and you know, and once the first two are in, at least in kindergarten or first grade, maybe the pressure's off and suddenly they think, well, let's go for number 3. Anyway, it'd be really interesting to know what motivates going from 2 to 3 kids, because that's the decision that every society needs to focus on and incentivize if it's going to survive.
Definitely. You know what? The Holman Institute, we've been doing polling for less than a year, so we have a bunch of more polls we can do in the future, and we do plan on redoing these polls and re-polling them to track positive changes, but also to explore these questions that come up that our poll suggests, like how do we get from 2 to 3? So we will definitely do that. We're going to stay around. We're going to keep doing this, and we will keep asking these cool questions.
Yeah.